Welcome to the CRE Shark Eye Show, where we discuss commercial real estate. This is your host, Ishai Breslauer. Here we meet every Monday to talk commercial real estate and prop tech. We will dive deep into the different asset classes, discuss the market, talk about the new and exciting technologies, meet key people in the industry, and get some inspiration. Let's begin. Hey guys, before we start, I just want to point out the 6 best secrets for commercial real estate. It's a free download. Go to the text side and you will find it. It has absolutely great information, completely free, how to become a landlord, how to determine the value of a property, or creative financing for commercial real estate. All of it is completely free. Go download it. Also, I want to point out my CRE crash course. It's a 2-week must-have program with a must-have skills for commercial real estate, like investment strategies, the must-have financial terms, how a deal is done. Go take a look at it, go to the text side and click on the link. And now let's continue with our program. Hi guys, this is Ishai Breslauer, your host of the CRE Shark Eye Show. I hope you guys are doing great today. We have today with us Barry Wolf. Barry, thank you for being with us. Really appreciate it.
No, likewise. Excited to be joining you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. And I'll tell you, everybody who's listening and watching, if you guys are watching or listening, it doesn't matter, because we have with us today an expert in the retail market, real estate retail market. We're going to hear all about it. And I'm so excited about this because this market has shifted so much. And we want to hear what's going on up, you know, today and how it's affected. Where are the good deals? Where are things being made? And obviously, every single thing in every single asset class, you can make money and you can make it happen. And we want to hear more about this. And we have an expert with us. Barry, before we even start digging into your story, I really appreciate if you could give us like a 2-minute elevator pitch.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I appreciate the opportunity. So yeah, I was a practicing a commercial real estate attorney prior to getting to brokerage. I did that for about 8 years or so. And I've been on the brokerage side with Marcus & Millichap since 2001. So 21 years doing that. And I largely sell single tenant net lease properties all over the country. And these are the buildings you see where we all live, unless you live in Manhattan like you do, or you drive around and you see bank buildings and drugstores and fast food chains and restaurants. We sell those all over the country. Have sold over 700 locations over the years. And I think last year we did 71 sales of about $252 million. So that's what we do. Also sell shopping centers in some parts of Florida, but nationally, as far as what people are listening to, we sell these single tenant retail buildings all over the country.
That gives us a lot of conversation because there's so much happening today also with those type, you know, with whatever e-commerce did it to, you know, to this whole market.
Absolutely.
And we're going to talk about it in depth. Tell me something before we get into all that. How did you get into this whole thing called real estate?
Well, I went to law school. My dad was a commercial real estate attorney. So I followed him, and as an attorney, I worked in commercial real estate. Back then, we worked with a lot of developers that were Walmart and Kmart developers, which, you know, back in the early 90s, Walmart and Kmart were neck and neck. It kind of shows you how things have changed. Kmart was a massive retailer. They did exceptionally well. If anything, they were kind of the market leader, with Walmart trying to catch up to them, which, you know, at the time, nobody knew quite how that would go. We also did a lot of work with some restaurant chains, Ruby Tuesday restaurants, which is kind of still around, Longhorn Steakhouse, some other restaurant chains. So when I decided to get into the brokerage field, again, about 21 years ago, it made sense to just stay in retail real estate, because that's what I had been doing as an attorney, had some relationships, but also just the knowledge, and just, you know, had some, you know, knew more about retail real estate than I did multifamily or industrial or hotels. So it just was a logical place to go.
Benjamin, was a logical place to go. And how many years was that, by the way?
That was 21 years ago. It'd be 22 wow. years this April. So in a couple months.
So you know what? That's amazing. That's incredible. I'll tell you, because people who come into the market today or getting to retail today, they see one perspective, and they don't see what used to be, what was.
Right.
And what was is very, very different.
So, you know, if you could give us a little bit, you know, some of the people who are listening, obviously are beginners, some of them are savvy operators, et cetera. But if you could give us a little bit of perspective of, meaning how it felt then, the 20 years ago, and how it feels now. Meaning,
so in other words, Barry, you're really old. Tell us what it was like when you first got in the business. Yeah, I mean, it was different. I mean, again, when I was practicing law, I mean, that's when the internet was first starting to roll out in the early 90s. I mean, we had computers, of course, although not everybody did. We had this thing called email that was starting to roll out. I went to the partners of the law firm. I said, you know, I think we need to get this email. instead of overnighting out documents and faxing.
You're exposing how old you are. So
I'm sorry. Yeah. So, but no, I mean, it just started. I mean, it's kind of one of those things, you get the ding, you've got mail. And, you know, that was the world we were in. And even in the early 2000s, when I first got into the brokerage side, you know, yes, we had the internet, but it was pretty new. So we were able to do some research and did some things online, but not other things we take for granted today. And, you know, the closings and transactions were still, you might have to overnight or mail documents or fax documents. So, you know, some of the things we take for granted, just the instantaneous nature of our business and our lives, that, again, you hit send and you got a document that's going all across the world in a fraction of a second. That didn't exist when I first got in the business. And again, you had to overnight or mail. And now we're able to do things at the speed of light, literally.
Tell me something. How much did the tenant mix change?
I mean, it certainly changed to a degree. Again, you know, when I first started, we were working with Walmart and Kmart developers. I mean, Kmart was a massive retailer back then. And obviously, yeah, they're still around kind of, sort of, a little bit, but not really. Certainly not as anything that matters. But no, I mean, there's a lot of brands that have come and gone since then. I mean, the Circuit Cities of the world. I mean, a lot changed in the financial crisis back in 2008. Fortunately, we didn't lose too many, you know, due to COVID. We thought we might. So it certainly changed. I mean, the brands have changed, and that's always happens. You've always got some retailers that are coming and going and new brands. And one of the things I thought was a positive of COVID is you had brands that were hanging on by their fingernails that probably got, you know, kicked out in a matter of months that would have taken years and years. And then you've got a lot of new brands, the digitally native brands that are coming out and are growing and getting into retail establishments. So COVID in the last couple of years just accelerated the process of a lot of new brands coming on, and, you know, some that went away, but fortunately not terribly many in reality. I mean, there weren't massive foreclosures, or certainly not massive store closures that we thought we would see during COVID. If anything, we've seen significantly more store openings over the last 24 months than we've seen closures, which has been, you know, a breath of fresh air.
Breath of fresh air, and we'd love to hear what types. But you know what, going back, still dwelling in the past a little bit before we get to the future, yeah, which is going to be obviously the main part of the show. Yeah. You've mentioned, and you have a unique experience with the Kmart versus the Walmart.
Right.
That's a very interesting story, because we all know where Walmart came to be, you know?
Yeah.
Probably the leader in their industry.
Them and Amazon are the two in retail. They're the 800-pound gorillas.
Exactly.
Everybody's just trying to stay up with them.
And you've mentioned the Kmart. So why would you say, I heard millions of answers to that, but there are obviously a few main ones, but I would like to hear your perspective, because you have hands-on perspective. Why did Kmart fail? Why Walmart float?
I could even go back before Kmart. Why did Sears fail? I mean, they haven't gone totally off the radar just yet. They will eventually. But I mean, Sears, before Kmart, Sears, if you go back in the early 1900s, Sears was Amazon before Amazon existed. Before the internet, you had this catalog company, this massive, massive retailer called Sears. I mean, you had the Sears Tower, literally. They were the Amazon of their day, and they were around for many, many years, many decades. Then Kmart came along, and they were kind of Walmart before there was a Walmart, this massive big box retailer that was kind of trying to change things and steal the business away from Sears back then. And I think the answer with Kmart is, They had a lot of, they took on too much debt. They failed to evolve. The blue light special, just for those who don't know that, that was kind of the kind of the price chopper, or what I'm trying to remember what it's called, with Walmart has now. But you'd literally have a blue light in the store flashing of where the sales were. The stores just got out of date. They became really crappy, poor condition. I guess Kmart became, over a period of years, I'd say basically a joke. They just didn't evolve. They didn't modernize. And you had Sam Walton came in and just came in with bigger stores, more modern, far, far better distribution system, which again, is kind of the Amazon model. Technologically, they evolved unlike Kmart ever did. Distribution was a huge part of the reason that Walmart has really succeeded, similarly to with Amazon. And that's why I think those two are the two massive retailers. It gets back to technology as much as anything.
You know,
Kmart
so
didn't evolve in that regard.
For sure. And you know, it's so interesting what you say, because in the end of the day, it comes out to negligence in terms of the management aspect of it.
Right.
And that's what it is. You know what?
Yeah, Kmart and Walmart, Kmart and Sam's, I'm sorry, Kmart and Sears, interestingly, right, they eventually became the same company. So you had these two massive retailers that both have imploded over the last couple of decades that, you know, became under the same ownership and same, you know, a lot of overly leveraged, and both, you know, were the two dominant retailers of their generation that, you know, failed hand in hand.
That's very cool. You know, fast forward to where we are today. You know, you probably, this, I would say the COVID conversation is already, you know, it's like a gum that's sort of been chewed millions of times. We all know what happened. 70% of, you know, the revenues, et cetera, nationwide. Obviously, in some places it was better than other places. We all know what happened. You said yourself that certain retailers stopped being in business, meaning went out of business, and that new ones came in. We're now in the post-COVID world, pretty much, give or take.
I hope. We'd like to think.
Yeah, we all hope that. But, you know, retailers are back, and retail is basically back. In certain areas, it's still evolving. It's still slowly coming back, but not back. But it will be back eventually. Right. And the big question is, how do you see the difference today in the types of, meaning with the balance between, let's say, brick and mortars and e-commerce, and the shift, you know, to industrial from retail, because those two are correlated. How do you see that? And how do you feel that in day-to-day business that you do?
I think it's still evolving. You know, online did obviously exceptionally well in, you know, 2020, 2021, it's not going away. Amazon's not disappearing or going anywhere. I believe they're only going to continue growing and only going to become a bigger factor in the industry. Retailers on the brick and mortar side, I think, have done a good job of evolving. They've got to offer the customer something. Amazon is so easy to order from. It's frictionless. And you sit, you know, using your phone or on your computer that we're on, you click a button or two, and it's at your home in a matter of hours, worst case, the next day. That's the world we're in. So I think retailers are going to have to either offer something unique, maybe in the way of an experience, a treasure hunt of sorts, like TJ Maxx and some other retailers offer, or just at least a very frictionless experience where you can maybe place it online and go do curbside pickup. Or if you want to go inside, it's very easy, and it's not, you're not waiting in a long line, and there's a benefit to going in the store. Retailers that don't evolve, like the Kmarts back in the day, if they're just counting on customers coming to them and buying from them, they're not going to survive long term, because Amazon is just too simple, too easy to order from, and Walmart is doing the same with online. Target is evolving as well. So it's a sector that's going to continue to evolve. I think we're in the fairly early innings, in reality, of kind of that evolution with e-commerce. Yeah, there's a lot to still come online. I mean, if you think about it, it's staggering how recent e-commerce has evolved. I mean, the iPhone is, you know, about, it's kind of what started it with the apps and everything else, but it's only about 11, 12 years ago. It's not that long ago. We're not talking about technology that's been around for generations. It's literally years. It's not even decades.
You're right, and it's an incredible involvement. Barry, I'll tell you something. I want to talk about the strip centers today, the shopping centers, and the involvement of those and what's happening with that today and what type of deals we have today. And the difference, I would say, between the strip center, the strip mall, whatever you want to call it, versus the mall, the classic shopping mall that was built in the 80s and what we were used to
at the time. The enclosed malls?
Yeah. What's with that? And why do you think certain malls are still alive and still doing well versus those others that are, you know, white elephants waiting to be redeemed in other ways and, you know, demolished or become a multifamily or hotels or who knows what? What do you think about all that? What do you see in the market?
One thing that's interesting as it relates to COVID, I mean, we had read numbers, you know, back in early 20 or mid 2020. I mean, we thought, you know, 35% of enclosed malls were going to fail and close, that over that next 12 to 18 to 24 months. I mean, we certainly saw some closures to a degree and some that were struggling or, you know, had more struggles than otherwise, but the enclosed mall sector is surprisingly, it maintained itself. I'm not bullish overall necessarily of the enclosed mall sector. I think you're going to see best in class malls continue to do well and thrive, but I don't think you're going to see, like where I live, I've got three or four enclosed malls within a 15-20 minute drive. I don't think that's needed. So I think you have the best in class, a couple in this, each city survive, you know, if you look out 10-15 years from now and doing well. To me, it's just an outdated concept personally, the enclosed mall, whereas open air retail has done exceptionally well. And I think that will continue. I think open air being, you know, something other than enclosed mall, you just pull up the park, you know, it's got the massive parking fields, you drive up and you get curbside pickup from a lot of the retailers, you run in and out of the couple of stores you're looking for. That sector has done very well during COVID in the last year or so. Leasing has been just shockingly strong. In 2021, you're seeing a lot of retailers that are expanding, you know, adding locations, a lot of, you know, digitally native brands that are opening stores. So I think we're continuing to see that. And again, one, maybe the biggest surprise in retail is the strength of leasing in the retail sector, in these open air retail centers has done quite well.
It's amazing. And it's also incredible that the types of leases, meaning the longer term leases are back and we see them coming back, right?
Which I agree with you. That is surprising. Again, you would have thought back in mid-20 or really any time in 2020 that any leases that would be done, you'd be talking, you know, much shorter lease terms, a couple of years instead of 10, 15, 20 years. And I think there are retailers absolutely that are trying to keep lease terms shorter. So not everybody's out there doing 15, 20 year leases or even 10 year. So there are retailers trying to be, you know, do shorter term leases. But you're right. I mean, these aren't 1 and 2 year leases. These are multi-year leases that are being done with national retailers largely.
Tell me something. If I ask you to differentiate between the moms and pops and the nationals, obviously we knew what happened in COVID and everybody was shocked with what happened then. Meaning all of a sudden the nationals were the ones who said, I'm not paying. And the moms and pops were struggling and tried to do that and tried to actually stay in business, which was a shock. I mean, pre-COVID, something with that would happen. Nobody knew it will happen. You would ask, people would say, I think that the nationals will stay strong and be there. But what is your perspective today on the nationals versus the moms and pops? And what's your thought process when you make a deal today or when you present a deal to investors?
I think it just depends on the center. I mean, if you've got a large center or a large space, that's probably leans more towards the nationals. And you're right. I mean, one of the things that, you know, we experienced or we saw during COVID is, as you said, the nationals that tended to come to the landlords with, you know, more requests for help and concessions and deferments, whereas the mom and pops largely rolled up their sleeves and did their darndest to make it work. And maybe they eventually needed a little bit of help, but largely the requests for concessions and deferments did come from the nationals, much more than the mom and pops. I think it depends on the size of the space you're trying to fill. I think it depends on the center. You know, some centers lend themselves more like a power center towards more nationals, whereas you know, other strips based on the location might lean itself more towards the local tenancy. I mean, there's always a core base of strong local tenants in these centers, whether it's the nail salon, the local pizza guys, the restaurants, things like that. I mean, service-oriented industries that, you know, tend to lean a little bit more towards mom and pops, although obviously there's a plenty of national restaurant chains. But the service sector does lean a little bit more towards mom and pops, and they tend to be very stable. I mean, you know, the centers we all go into, whether it's a nail salon, a dry cleaner, the local Chinese restaurant, they all, you know, a lot of times these are folks that stay in there for many, many years and are successful for at times even generations. So, I mean, it's the mom and pop retailers are the backbone, I do feel, of the retail sector. I mean, I have tremendous respect for those mom and pop operators.
You know what, when you come, it's a great perspective, by the way, but when I want to ask you something a little different. When you come to check a deal and see if that's something that you want to either buy or broke, being, you know, right, sell it out, what are your, I would say, 3 to 5 things that you would be caring most? Meaning, obviously, you want to know that it's a great location. These are all big words, right? Because you want to see the types of leases, the types of tenants, their car counts, how many people are coming every day or every week or every this or every that, and the stores and the revenues that are making. There's so many aspects when it comes to retail. The knowledge base is so much higher than understanding multifamily, which is people live in there and that's it, you know. And retail, you have to know all these other factors that are related to the businesses. What are your, I would say, bullet points that you care the most when you come and you look at a retail center and say, okay, this one I can sell?
I'd say, location always matters, obviously. Access, visibility, the shape of the center even is, I think, something that's pretty critical. Is it sit parallel, you know, all straight parallel to the street versus maybe kind of a, you know, L-shape where you've got an elbow in there that can be challenging to lease? I'm going to look at lease terms. I mean, the first thing I'm going to probably do is pull out the rent roll. Obviously, look at the things I'm looking for, the lease term. What's the stability look like? How long have the tenants been there? Do you have a lot of tenants that have, you know, that were there before that didn't make it for one reason or another? Or you've got a base of tenants that have been there for 10, 15, 20 years. That's always a, you know, great positive. If you've got a tenancy that's had really strong stability for many years, maybe they've been through a couple of economic cycle or two even. If I see they made, you know, I've got a lot of tenants that were there and maybe they came in early 2000s and they made it through the financial crisis. They made it through COVID.
That means
that tells me a lot. Whereas if there's if you've got a rent roll that it's all brand new tenants, well, that tells me there wasn't much stability there. And is there a reason that the tenants didn't make it? And then I'm gonna look closely at the rents being paid too. Am I in line with the market or am I above the market? You'd love to see a center that's fully occupied with, you know, long-term tenants paying low rents that you know are going to be able to do well. And maybe you got some upside that over time you might be able to grow that rental rate, grow the NOI. I think that's an ideal, again, as opposed to you're seeing top of the market or above market type rents where the rents may just not be sustainable and the tenants may not be sustainable.
It sounds good. Let me ask you this. In terms of, you probably work nationwide, if I'm
so
clearly. Everyone who does retail pretty much is nationwide. Which are the, I would say, preferable markets nowadays for you? Where would you look more versus, let's say, 5 or 6 years ago?
Well, I'm based in Florida, so I'm going to say Florida is a phenomenal market. I'm based here. Yeah, from COVID, we saw a lot of the money. There's tremendous capital coming out of the northeast part of the country where you're at that's, you know, looking into Florida. It's a vibrant economy. I say two of the strong ones are Florida and Texas, and there's similar reasons. Just vibrant economies, open economics, politically during COVID, and I'm not getting into politics at all, but the economy stayed open and did well. They're also here in the sun. Yeah, you got to have a lot of population growth coming to those two markets. I'd say pretty much this whole swath of the Sun Belt states. So seeing population growth really across the Sun Belt, Texas, across to Georgia, Florida, the Carolinas, Tennessee is a great market. I'm just saying, and a lot of it ties together. We're seeing population moving out of California and some of those markets into states like Texas, and a lot of folks leaving markets like the Northeast part of the country, New York, New Jersey, coming south to Florida, the Carolinas, into the Sun Belt. So those I think are probably the markets that I think have struggled a little bit would be those markets like California and New York, and the Sun Belt region I think has held up exceptionally well.
Tell me something, the retail center that you will not get close to. Mm-hmm. What would be the warning indicator that would tell you I'm not going to deal with that one? Obviously, we have some obvious ones. There's nothing there. There are no tenants. Okay, but
right.
Those that presumably they look good, everything is fine, right. But you say to yourself, I'm not going to get close to this.
Well, I think a concerning would be if you've got a center where the rents are just exceptionally high. Let's say you're in a $25 a foot market and you've got rents that are $45 a foot. Maybe it's newer construction and you've got high expense rates as well, typically. So that'd probably be something that I'd be a little concerned about. Just, do you have rents that are sustainable for the tenants? If the tenants are paying more than they can afford to pay and economically survive, then ultimately that's going to be a space or spaces that are going to come back to you and you're going to have to backfill potentially at lower rates.
So how are you going to know that, by the way? Okay, so they're paying a little more, but they're not showing you their what's going on in their books. So
well, hopefully you do get access to the sales reporting or just talking to the tenants how they're performing. And I think just knowing the markets, you need to do your homework on what are the rental rates in the market. And if you're well above what other centers in your immediate corridor are paying, that's something you want to look at. Is there a reason for that? Maybe it is. It's a newer constructed or better located center. And then can the tenants afford to pay whatever the current asking rent is? And do you have room to have some rental growth even perhaps or not?
It all comes down to understanding the markets eventually.
Absolutely.
And knowing what you're doing. You've mentioned in the very beginning that you do single tenant, right? Net lease also.
Right. Yeah.
And the big question that's coming up today, because this has been a very attractive, obviously, for 1031 exchange, and there's a whole talk about the 1031 exchange, whatever is happening with that, I don't know. But I'm saying in terms of the net lease aspect, the net lease aspect has been so attractive for those investors who don't know much about real estate. So they say, listen, I'm going to buy this thing. I want to be the owner. I want it to be mine. I don't want to do anything. So they come and the broker says, you don't have to do anything because you have this tenant who is basically doing everything. You just have to get a paycheck and have to buy it. So that's it. They do everything except for maybe one or two, and that's it. So here's the big question. Today, meaning it's been the same, I would say, give or take, that's why the caps were so low, meaning historically, with that asset class, and it's been the safest for those type of people. It's, mm-hmm. I know I have a 20 whatever year old year lease, that's what I'm going to do. However, today Amazon is out there and to get those too, the pharmacies. And the other types, what is your take on that? What do you see in the market? Do you see a shift already? You don't see a shift? You see a fear in the market, different perspective from investors, from people who are doing it. What is your perspective on it?
Yeah, I think we're certainly seeing some shift. You make some good points. I mean, drugstores, I posted the other day on LinkedIn, it was data from CoStar, drugstores closures, I think it was about 3,600 drugs, banks. It was referring to approximately 3,600 bank closures last year. I think that's going to only continue. Right. We've been coaching our clients not to, unless it's a very well located, a low rental rate, and they're looking more for the second, the opportunity to backfill it and add value there. For the passive investor you're talking about that's looking for just long-term stability, I'm not a fan of bank deals. I think you're going to see a lot more closures of banks. I'm not a fan of drugstore deals because the reasons you said. I think Amazon has gotten more and more into the drugstore sector. And anything retail, you've got to keep an eye on Amazon and Walmart and Costco. You've got to see what are they doing, and is whatever you're buying, are they getting into that airspace? And if they are, how does your tenant compete with those? And the drugstores, I think, they've got some challenges right now. I don't think, you know, CVS, Walgreens are going to go away, but they've got challenges. And, you know, Amazon with PillPack is gotten more and more competitive with the drugstore space, with just, you know, delivery of goods as well. So those would be two sectors I personally, again, unless the situation was just great real estate at low rent, I'm not encouraging clients to dive into drugstore bank deals. I'm a big fan of the restaurant sector, because that is a sector I don't think I see Amazon getting aggressively into. I wouldn't put it past them to get into maybe the ghost kitchen sector eventually. So I'm not saying Amazon won't ever get into the restaurant space entirely, but I think it's pretty safe right now, at least. So restaurants, I'm very bullish on. Fast food, I love. Anything with a drive-through if you've got a good operator. We're always keeping a very close eye on what is Amazon doing, Walmart doing, and how does that impact the overall sector.
That's a great, great perspective. And you know what's interesting? It's interesting to see everything you said, I agree with. And I wanted to understand one thing. The big question that is hovering upon us, that if everything happens, it's already happening to the banks and in future to the drugstores. There's some of the in-betweeners. Why? Because you have the strip center, we know what it is. Then you have those big box retailers, we know what that is. You know, you have Walmart, you have those big ones, you have the Costcos. They have those different types of real estates require different types of brick and mortar, different types of square footage, different types of boxes, different types of real estate. And then comes those CVS and Walgreens and banks, and they have those funny little shapes, you know? And the big question would be, and it's already there, and you experience it, all these banks that are closing, those funny little, I would call it boxes, because they're not here, not there. There's a word in Yiddish said, nishtaim, nishtaer, not here, not there. It's like in between. What do you do with those? What is happening with those? What is the potential of those? Is there an opportunity with those?
Well, again, that's one of the reasons I'm not a fan of the drugstore sector in particular, is the drugstore buildings, I think, are very difficult to backfill effectively. Typically, when I've seen, you know, Walgreens go out, I'll see maybe an Elegant Beauty go in there, or Dollar General, or Aaron's, or maybe an auto parts retailer, but it's typically going to be about 50 cents on the dollar of the rent. The shape and the size of those buildings are not overly conducive to backfilling effectively at the rate the CVS or Walgreens were paying previously. Banks, I'm a little less concerned with that, but I mean, it's not an invalid statement at all. So it's something you've got to look at. The positive is they do typically have drive-through. We've sold actually a number of backfilled bank deals as cannabis dispensaries. They're able to use benefit and use the vault. They might be using the drive-through. I've seen some bank deals backfilled as restaurants with maybe the vault used as a private dining area or store, you know, something along those lines. So bank deals, I mean, they tend to be on hard corners, well located. So I'm less bothered by the ability to backfill a bank deal than a drugstore. But again, if you're buying a, you know, new-ish bank that's at a big rent number, that would be a concern. But yeah, I mean, you're not wrong. I mean, I think that's something you've got to look at if you're buying a bank deal, a drugstore deal in particular, is what do I do if that tenant vacates, and, you know, how easily can I backfill them with a replacement tenant? And that can be challenging at times.
For sure. Tell me something. What is the financing environment today for retail?
Financing is quite strong. Lenders are back in favor with retail. Yeah, back in 2020, particularly I'd say March till, you know, through the summer, banks were really, you know, not touching retail hardly at all. Even restaurants, they didn't want to finance. I think everybody was just not sure where things were going. But now retail, banks are back in favor. You know, retail is back in favor rather with banks. Whether that's multi-tenant retail or single-tenant net lease with restaurants or even drugstores, banks. So now retail is definitely a highly financeable deal. It's not the leverage it was back, you know, pre-financial crisis. That changed things.
How different?
just the leverage is going to be less. Back pre-2008, you were looking at, you could potentially get 80, 90% financing on most retail deals. And now it became much more conservative, closer to maybe 60 to maybe 70%, which I think is a positive. A lot of it more personal recourse. So it's a little more conservative than it was, or more conservative than multifamily, but certainly a financeable sector for sure. For a qualified borrower, they look at the borrower very closely now as well too.
Tell me something. What is your favorable anchor tenant nowadays in a strip center?
Interesting. I mean, grocery is always in favor. Grocery anchored centers. I'm a big believer in the food sector still. What we were seeing pre-COVID was there's kind of saying that, food and restaurants are the new anchor, whereas, our fitness centers as well. And I think that's back in play again. And folks that have experiential retail opportunities where there's a reason for the consumer to go there. And it's not just run in and buy something that they could otherwise buy on Amazon. So I say, if you've got an anchor that's grocery, something that offers a unique experience for the consumer, food, fitness, those would be kind of the ones that excite me still. I mean, a good restaurant mix, I think, is fantastic. I was talking with somebody the other day that they're remodeling a Publix anchored center. They're redoing Publix entirely to fresh new model. They're putting in a fantastic Starbucks with a large patio and fans and covered patio, a great new Italian restaurant. Those are things that actually got me excited, just near where I live. And I was excited to hear some new restaurants coming in. So those are the things that excite me. I think those are the retailers that will continue to thrive and I think are exciting.
As we say, you can't drink through your phone. You still have to actually eat or drink.
Correct. And I'm a believer, pre-COVID, we as Americans, for the first time in history, we were spending more dining out than we were at grocery stores. That obviously during COVID that changed entirely. I mean, restaurant spending plummeted and grocery spending soared. That is getting back closer to, again, where we were. And I do believe that it hadn't happened this year. I do think in the foreseeable future, we will again be as a society spending more dining out at restaurants than we are at the grocery store. You're never gonna be able to do that on your phone. I mean, we are ordering food on our phone. That's certainly evolving. And the restaurants need to offer a frictionless experience, whether that's delivery or quick curbside pickup or drive-through, even if it's a casual dining chain. I think you're gonna see that. It's certainly an evolving sector, but it's not something that's terribly at risk to Amazon or Walmart, at least not now. Not to say that won't happen, but not now.
Right. I want to shift gears a little bit. I want to ask you a question. How would you educate us a little bit between the, the triple tenant situation or existence versus the ground lease aspect? If you could give us a little bit of perspective from your end on those.
Well, the triple net, I think what you're referring to, these are these totally passive deals. You're as a buyer, you're buying them, the tenant maintains the building, the roof, the structure, the parking lot. They pay the taxes, they pay the insurance directly. And all you do is you collect a rent check once a month that ideally gets wired into your account. The benefit of those deals, first of all, there's no maintenance. You don't do anything. But assuming it's just a triple net lease where you own the building and the real estate, you're able to depreciate the building. So there's a lot of tax benefits to that. There's also cost segregation where you can take, if you're a real estate professional, take accelerated depreciation, offset that even, again, if you're quote unquote a real estate professional from a tax standpoint, you offset that against even your income. The ground lease, what that is, you're buying the land underneath the building. The tenant built the building, so they own the building. You don't get the depreciation benefits. It still offers a triple net aspect to it. Tenant maintains the building. At the end of the lease term, the building reverts to you as the landowner, but you lose those tax benefits. But still, a lot of investors, if they did an exchange, maybe they've already depreciated out. They don't have the benefits of depreciation anymore anyway. So a ground lease can be very attractive. For others, I think you'd want to talk to your accountant and just see, you're better off buying the building as well and have that depreciation benefit.
From a tenant perspective, ground lease, is there any benefit for that, you think?
Sometimes that's all they can do. I mean, we've gotten an environment now. Yeah, the landowner is not willing to sell the land to a developer or to the tenant. So all they're willing to do is lease it to them. And they don't, as a landowner, they don't want to develop the building. So they say, Mr. Tenant, if you want my site, if you want my hard corner, I'll ground lease it to you. That's all I'm going to do. You go, you lease the land from me, you build the building at your cost and your headache. And so I think that's the biggest benefit at times. That's the only way you can get the location. We're seeing more and more of that in prime locations where the only way the tenant can do the deal is to do a ground lease.
That's always an interesting thing. Barry, before we said our goodbyes, and I really thank you for this, and we could talk for another 2 hours about retail and about what's happening today and different structures and different types of things around that. It's such an interesting topic always. If you could tell us, you guys could see the links above, below, how to get Barry. Barry, please tell us how to get in touch with you.
Yeah, well, I think it's in the background behind me, to the left or the right, depending on how it's showing up. LinkedIn is a great way.
Some people are in the podcast medium, they can't hear, so tell them.
That's true. Yeah, so that's true. Exactly. So, yeah, if you go on LinkedIn, look me up, Barry Wolf, hashtag NetleasePro. So that'd be a good way. You can find me there. My phone number's on there, my email. If you're not on LinkedIn, I'm with Marcus and Millichap in Fort Lauderdale, and my phone number is 954-245-3493. So happy to talk with anybody.
Perfect. And I'll tell you something. This was exciting. We learned a lot, and we're hearing, you know, what's happening in the retail market. Always exciting about that. And I really thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And thank you guys for being with us. And I'll see you in the next show.
Hey guys, thanks for joining me in this CRE Shark Eye show. I hope you enjoyed it. And go subscribe, download, do whatever you guys need to do. And I'll see you in the next episode. Take care of yourselves.